This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of the Indie Media Show with your host, Alex Wisson. Not been in the studio for a while, so super excited to be here. It's a pleasure and a privilege, as always. I'm joined in the studio by my illustrious co-host, Kelly Warden. How are we this morning, Kelly?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. It's lovely to be back here. And, of course, a very big, big thank you to Jeff for another fine edition of On The Record. He's having some sort of mobility issues and things going on in the studio. It's all a bit dramatic. But, no, he's got a big smile on his face, and that's what we like to see. Magnificent beard going as well. So I hope you've enjoyed, Jeff. And look, enough tomfoolery and shenanigans. Plenty coming up on the show today. Very shortly, in fact, we're going to be speaking to a regular guest on the show. He's worn many hats over the years. A very astute political commentator, our own Sam Wainwright, will be talking about the results of the first round of the French presidential elections. About 90% of the votes counted, with the incumbent, as expected, Emmanuel Macron winning a plurality of the vote, but also, as expected, nowhere near a majority of the vote. So it will go to a second round with the, she no longer likes to think of herself as a fascist, a so-called post-fascist, whatever that is. But, of course, she's still fascist to the core, and she's fooling nobody in the form of Marine Le Pen, who's set to go off against Macron in the second round. So we'll be speaking to Sam about all of that, some of the wider political implications of the French elections in the context of European warfare. And what else have we got coming up on the show, Kelly?
We've also got a conversation with Megan Cracker, WA's own, talking about her campaign as she runs for the Senate with the WA Social Justice Independent Party. So having a conversation with her about all the social justice issues that they're campaigning to change and shift, and you know, what they'll do if they get into the Senate. And also having a conversation with my friends from Voices of Influence Australia, which is a youth-led human rights organisation that's dedicated to try and get young people involved in democratic spaces. So they're going to be talking about the federal budget impacts on young people and just the general issue more broadly with the underrepresentation of youth voices in government decision making. So it's a pretty hefty hour coming up.
A hefty hour indeed, but important stuff, and I hope that you can be with us for the upcoming hour. Very pleased to be joined on the line now by political commentator, as we said in the intro, a man who wears many hats on this show, Sam Wainwright. One of the hats he wears is something of a local expert on French politics. Very glad for you to join us this morning, Sam.
Thanks very much. And look, I'll try and be modest. I won't claim to be an expert on French politics, but it is something I've followed relatively closely. And I've lived in France, been active politically in France, the times I've lived there, and did a thesis on the 2017 presidential election.
There you go. Well, I think all of that resume constitutes expertise in my mind, and in all seriousness, your commentary on social media is much appreciated. Now, Sam, unlike Australian federal elections, where we're entering, of course, yet another race where there are really only two players in the game, notwithstanding the fact the Greens do harbour ambitions as the third force, the French presidential elections, by contrast, like most European elections, features multiple parties and no single candidate approaching anything like true majority support. We'll try and go through some of those candidates one by one, time permitting, then examine the wider possible political implications of the poll. Let's start with the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron. He's constantly described by the mainstream media as a centrist. What does that really mean, centrist, in the context of French politics, and what has been his agenda during his 5 years in office?
I would say that means that he has a thin veneer of being socially progressive or ecological, which is more rhetoric than reality, but in practice he is a sort of a conventional neoliberal conservative when it comes to economic matters. So his record of government has been fundamentally not to deliver on his promises around climate change, but driving hard on so-called neoliberal reform. And the most significant thing he had attempted to do was to so-called reform the French pension system, that is to force people to work longer and have to pay more in but for their pension system, something that he failed to do because of mass resistance. He had to back off that during his campaign, but he has signalled that he will try again if re-elected.
Now, as you say, he has by and large stuck to the orthodox neoliberal playbook while at the same time casting himself as a, you know, the sensible centre. On the other side of the ledger, on the extreme right, of course, is Marine Le Pen. The exit polls, some 90% of the votes now counted, is showing Macron at 27.6%, Le Pen not too far behind at 23.4%. Now, there's a long and notorious history with Marine Le Pen. She stood several times before. Her father was a former French paratrooper in Algeria, a committed fascist, a racist, once arrested outside the European Parliament in 1999 with a shotgun in the back of his car. And, you know, all kinds of speculations about his involvement in terrorist activities, you know, back in the 80s and indeed in Algeria itself. Anyway, lots to be said about all of that, Sam. But, I mean, Le Pen, just briefly tell us what her politics are. She's sort of claiming that she's now left her fascist past behind her as an attempt to, you know, to win quote-unquote respectability. Is she still a fascist? And how do you fancy her chances in this upcoming second round of the polls?
Yeah, I would say that she still is a fascist, although it's certainly true that she has attempted to sort of soften or make more respectable the image of her political party, which used to be called the National Front and now is called the National Rally. She, as you said, her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, founded the organisation, and the people of his generation that founded the National Front were people very much identified both with the Vichy collaborationist regime and also people who resisted Algerian independence and were identified with the coup against President Charles de Gaulle, who at a certain point pragmatically recognised that France had to pull out of Algeria. But there was a layer of, you know, there was a right-wing sort of faction in the army who couldn't accept that. So that, and you know, in addition to Jean-Marie Le Pen's other outrages, he, you know, he described the Holocaust as a detail of history, among other things. Now, she's interesting because she, in her determination to, you know, soften the image of her political party somewhat, and also in recognition of the fact that, you know, a modern sort of fascist or proto-fascist project can't be associated with the old symbolism of Nazism. I mean, that symbolism is totally discredited amongst you know, the majority of the population. And furthermore, anti-Semitism is not the go-to scapegoat of you know, in Western politics today. It's Islamophobia. So she has successfully sought to reorient her project, you'd have to say, and to win over voters from the traditional right parties. I mean, an interesting but also scary sort of dynamic of this election campaign was that did open up space on her right flank and actually saw the emergence of an even more right-wing candidate.
Talking about Eric Zemmour there. So he's only recorded 7% of the vote, Eric Zemmour, who's, as I understand it, a journalist, sort of muckraking, basically racist journalist. But 7%, Sam, how has he done compared to his expectations?
Less than expectations, because there were a month ago, he was polling more than Le Pen. So there was a real duel for who was going to be the authentic voice of the far right, which Le Pen has ended up winning. What tends to happen is as you get closer to election day, the votes tend to polarise around sort of key polls. So compared to an Australian election, even the results as they stand now show a very fragmented political landscape. But a month out, opinion polls had it even more fragmented. But what tends to happen is, as you get closer to polling day, there's a pressure for people to vote not for the candidate that they identify with the most, but the candidate they think has a chance of winning they identify with the most. So you tend to get... So that's what's happened this time. Essentially, the vote is polarised around three polls, whereas a month ago, it was more split sort of five, six ways.
And by the time we get to the second round, it's a question of the least worst alternative, really, isn't it? Now, 11 candidates overall. We won't have time to get to all of them. But one of the more important ones, of course, is Jean-Luc Mélenchon, considered the great hope of the left, although, you know, I personally have some criticisms of his politics, as I'm sure you do, Sam. 22% he recorded, so he misses out on the second round. Now, pointedly, he didn't do this when he last ran in 2017 in terms of calling for a vote for Macron in the second round, but he said that four times in his sort of speech after the results came in. He said, you know, you must vote against Le Pen. I don't know if he specifically said vote for Macron, but vote against Le Pen. So how important is that in terms of that Mélenchon vote coming out in the second round? Because one concerning thing is I saw the abstention figure, Sam, was at a whopping 26%, 4% above 2017. So is that a concern that people might just simply not show up in the second round?
Look, that is a danger. No question about it. So as you say, there was a record, that abstention rate was actually a record. So it was even greater than last time. So it does mark a real disengagement from politics and a sort of stuck to all kind of attitude, which is quite widespread. I mean, you know, nearly 75% of the population voting in a place where voting is not compulsory is actually quite high compared to any other, you know, compared to other countries, compared to the United States, for instance. I mean, it actually shows a very high engagement of politics with politics amongst the general population. But by French standards, that is a that's quite significant. That's a record high abstention rate. And certainly the challenge for Mélenchon was to convince people that would otherwise not bother voting to vote. That was always going to be the key to his success, and you'd have to say that he had made moderate success in doing that. So he's got a bigger vote than he did in 2017, where it was more like 19%. So that has been a success on his part. But yes, no, for the second round, the challenge now is to convince people to sort of hold their nose and vote for Macron, regardless, knowing that a Le Pen victory would be worse, and that is the greatest. That's a real danger. I don't think it's likely that Le Pen would win. I mean, opinion polls, don't precisely tell the future, but you know, opinion polls have asked people, you know, if it was a second round runoff between Macron and Le Pen, who would you vote for? And that sort of generally gives Macron around 56%. Whereas a second round runoff between Macron and Mélenchon was sort of more like 58%, 60% for Macron. So I'm pretty certain that Macron will still win. But no, there is a real danger that people who voted for some of the other candidates will just not bother.
Now, unfortunately, we're limited for time today, Sam. There's so much more we can talk about, and I'm sure we'll get you on at the time of the second round. But just briefly, and we'll end on this note, and I recognise it's a bit of a question from left field, but and perhaps it wasn't a factor, but to what extent was there a factor of this being a car key election? Macron has positioned himself as the top European diplomat. He's prided himself on the fact that he's had direct personal phone calls with Putin. Yeah, very much part of this ongoing French ruling class project to flex French muscles and, you know, jostling with Germany as the leader of Europe and so on and so forth. So, you know, very much seen as kind of a wartime, trying to cast himself as a wartime leader, as a great diplomat and so on and so forth. Has that sort of played into the election? Because I sort of bring it back in a way, sort of a connection to the Australian elections, which a lot of people are forecasting are going to be, you know, a car key election here as well.
Macron got a sort of initial bump up in his approval rating when the Russian invasion of Ukraine took place. And, you know, even in a sort of silly kind of way, tried to model himself on Zelensky a bit, you know, started wearing T-shirts, you know, eating in public and, you know, not shaving for a few days and this sort of stuff. But that quickly peaked and actually his vote declined since then. So, as you said, he ended up with about 27% on the actual day, but immediately after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, he sort of bumped up to around 30%, but that then started to decline. So it didn't play a decisive factor, even though his campaign worked very hard and even put out memes saying that a vote for Le Pen or Mélenchon would be a vote for Putin. That was a sort of that was their kind of dirty tricks angle. Now, in the case of Le Pen, I mean, in the past she has been funded by sources in Russia. The way they tried to sort of make that label stick on Mélenchon was because of the fact that Mélenchon, while condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is also an outspoken opponent of NATO and France's membership of NATO and Western militarism more generally. Of course, Mélenchon was able to counter with pictures of himself meeting Russian dissidents, you know, recently released from jail over the past few years, versus pictures of Macron...
glad-handing Putin, I imagine.
summit. But, you know, that's how these sort of campaigns play out. So, you know, in the end, I don't think Ukraine was so decisive.
Yeah, all very interesting, Sam. And as I say, we'll see how much of a factor that plays into to the Australian federal election. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and we'll have you again on soon, I'm sure.
Good on you. Thanks for the opportunity.
That's Sam Wainwright, local political commentator, talking to us about the first round of the French presidential elections.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTR FM 92.1.
We're jumping straight into our next interview with Megan Cracker, who is a First Nations lawyer and the project director of the National Suicide Prevention and Trauma Recovery Project, which has supported over 20,000 people over the 3 years of its existence. She's worked in social justice, outreach, community campaigning, in policy, and in caring for community for decades. She's contributed to the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse and is part of a team leading the Banksia Hill class action against the inhumane treatment of minors in WA's notorious juvenile detention centre. At the beginning of the year, Megan announced that she would run for Senate in the upcoming election as part of the Social Justice Independent Party. And today we were fortunate to have a chat with her and find out more about this political campaign. And I started by asking Megan what actually prompted her to enter into the political game.
Kelly, thank you for your time. Really appreciate the time that you've given to give us a platform on your important radio station. That's really quite important to take out the voices of the unheard, the invisible and so forth. Gerry Georgiadis and myself, we've worked with the National Suicide Prevention and Trauma Recovery Project for the last 3 odd years. During that time, we've come across 20,000 people. We've supported 20,000 people right across the nation around discrimination, around suicides, death in custody, incarceration, homelessness, child removals, and we found ourselves on the streets, in the homes, in the hospitals, in the prisons, and basically that's what we've been doing. Now, in terms of this election, in terms of the social justice independence, this campaign is just validating everything that we already know. And to go on a bit further, Gerry and I, between us, we've got 11 degrees. 11 degrees, we've actually been into a number of countries. Gerry, for example, has been to 67 countries with international aid work, and the work that he does is absolutely beautiful, and he had a story out on Saturday in the West Australian. In terms of myself, I've been to a number of remote communities. I've been in the 27 prisons right across the nation in relation when I was working with the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. So we've always worked in the most marginalised space, and we're trying to give voice to many. And that is the main reason for running in this race and the race to the Senate. We want to get there. We know that there's 6 positions that are available in Western Australia, but we also know that we're the best candidates because we do have the deficit discourse. We understand it like no other, and we fight relentlessly in the media in terms of ways forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you say, it's quite unique what you guys are doing in that you've campaigned for so long, for longer than I've been alive, actually. you've actually been out there doing the work on the ground, and you know, now what you're doing is actually bringing that to the table and trying to get that space to change how the system is operating. And I guess in saying that, one of the things that you've been talking about and that you talk about, you know, in your campaign is the issue with the way that the system is currently treating people and how, you know, government after government, you just see communities be desolated by different policy and different laws that are, you know, being decided by the people up in Canberra, but not being led by people in community. And I guess I was wondering, I mean, obviously you probably have a lot of critiques, but what do you think are your sort of biggest critiques of the government today?
Well, one of the biggest ones, and one that affects all of us as Australians, is a Bill of Rights. Now, whether it's the Labor governments, whether it's Liberal government, for years on there has not been a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights is the overrate, and this is one of the things that we would advocate for, we would be relentless about, because this affects all people in this country. But the Bill of Rights, in our mind, is the overarching statement that this nation needs, and the underwriting that all facets of society will be supported by. So in that sense, it's really quite important to have a Bill of Rights, and I can't believe that none of the major parties, none of the micro parties, have even introduced a bill into the highest legislative body in the country. So the Bill of Rights, that will basically make people more equal, so as not to leave people behind. So, for example, in the prisons, there's 44,000 people in 115 prisons right across the nation. They do not have access to Medicare. So what that means is that doctors and so forth cannot work in those prisons. If I put it in the Aboriginal context, there's over 240 Aboriginal medical services right across the country. And how it works is when an Aboriginal medical service provides a service to a person, there are the Medicare rebates. The very second that you step into a prison, you are denied Medicare. So the Aboriginal medical services cannot provide a service into any one of these prisons right across this nation. And having worked up at Acacia Prison, myself and Jerry, for a period of 9 months, where we'd come into contact with at least 1,200 people, and as you know, Acacia Prison, that's the largest prison in the Southern Hemisphere. There's 1,500 gentlemen in that particular prison. But we've worked with, you know, we've come into contact with at least 1,200, and we've worked substantively with 400. In that, what happened in that sense, there were three Aboriginal people that died in custody within a year period. And once we'd started working there, within the first quarter, the self-harms had gone down from 33 to 3. It was about the spreading of the love. It was about working with people in terms of providing that intense psychosocial support, and the assertive outreach and the 24/7 approach. In Banksia Hill, the same situation. So there's 17 youth detention centres right across this nation. But Banksia Hill, where there is a class action against Banksia Hill, we supported the young girls. And the young girls in the Yeeta, there were 18 young girls when we walked in. When we left, there were 7 and 8 week periods. But the Bill of Rights also extends to residents. So right across the nation, there's 2 million residents right across the nation, and in terms of visas and so forth. And if you're on residency, you don't have the same kind of equal access as a citizen to health, welfare, legal. Now, that's discrimination at its best for all Australians. So these are some of the things that we, if we get elected into the Senate, are what we will be fighting. But the Bill of Rights, in my mind, why is it? Why is it that no other major party, why is it that no other micro party has introduced the Bill of Rights? And that is so, so, so important, because it affects everything that we do.
And why do you think that other parties haven't been looking to introduce a Bill of Rights? Because that was actually going to be my next question, was asking you about the Bill of Rights. And it is quite unique in that not a lot of other candidates are focusing on this. And I was wondering what you sort of think is the reason why they're choosing not to.
I'm not too sure. I suppose I can't answer that because I'm not sure what's in their minds. But in our minds, as Social Justice Independent, it makes perfect sense. So in terms of deportations from the previous government, where there was at least 100 people that were being deported back to other countries, now we have at least 1,000 people a year that's being deported to other countries. 1,000 people. Now, that's a double-edged sword. If a person goes into the prison system, well, that's their time done over and done with. But under the regime, they go into Yolngu Hills, for example. And many times, and my colleague Jerry Georgiadis and I, but more so him, he's been fighting deportation. These families, these individuals in these horrors of human misery, they're denied legal access. And the legal access is not strong if they do have it. So what that's doing is separating a family. You have a person who's up in Yongan Hills, and this is where we talk about refugee rights and deportations. They're in Yongan Hills, for example, in Western Australia. Because we've got 1,000 people that are now being deported, some of these gentlemen, they're leaving their families behind, their children, their wives, their uncles, their aunties, their mothers and fathers that are living in the state of Western Australia. And if they're to be deported to places where they haven't had much association, it's breaking up a family. And that is what we want to fight for, to keep our families together. Everyone needs to be entitled that legal access, the welfare. And if you've done your time in jail, well, then you should be able to go home to your family. That's all about redemption, isn't it? And that goes on in terms of rehabilitation. What rehabilitation do people have in the prison systems? I can tell you right now, we're damaging people more by sending them into prisons. And when they get out, they're walking out with no identification in many cases. And I've seen it. I pick people up. They're walking out with just their prison ID, no photo ID, no birth certificate. If you've been in prison longer than 3 years, your bank account's being closed. So that's putting people at the most marginalised and vulnerable in from the prison system, basically going up against the odds. And then to compound it further, homelessness is a massive issue, where we've got 18,000 families still on the wait list in Western Australia, equating to 44,000 homeless or houseless. Now, that should not be happening in this state of Western Australia, where we are rich. Rich in the sense that it's a $5 billion surplus, to the point where we're having our brothers and sisters die on the street. Is that the type of world that our people should be living in? So I'm not sure why the other parties, the majors, the micros and others, have not introduced a Bill of Rights. To me, it makes sense. It makes sense to the people that are being deported. It makes sense to the 2 million residents in this country. It makes sense to the 44,000 people that are incarcerated right across this nation in 115 adult carceral states, and also the 17 juvenile detention centres. To me, it is a way forward. Now, the other thing that I will just say quickly on that, this Bill of Rights, it would be powerful, and it would lead not only the country, but across the world. Very few Bill of Rights are in other countries and other jurisdictions. This is a way forward. It's progressive, it's loving, it's caring, and it's protecting the rights of all Australians, and basically we're all brothers and sisters of the human family, and that's what we're about. That's one of the big things for us.
My next question, and you kind of already briefly touched on this, was talking about the class action in Banksia Hill. And, you know, billions of dollars, as you said, are being pumped into these correctional services every year. But, you know, in the case of Banksia Hill, we're seeing that about 70% of child inmates are going on to adult prison and being held in these perpetual cycles of incarceration. So you've already touched on this, about this system just not working and actually doing more damage to people that are already in, you know, prejudiced situations. And to me, that just isn't a good way to be spending taxpayers' dollars when there's projects like yours, a suicide prevention project that's literally saving lives and has gone largely unfunded. And, you know, since the Black Lives Matter movement, there's been a really strong discourse around this idea of defunding the police, defunding correctional services, and actually putting that money back into community support and community-led initiatives. And I think, yeah, the work that you've been doing is such a good example of this. So could you talk a little bit more about this idea of defunding the police and the kind of systems overhaul you think we need to see to truly keep kids out of custody?
Sure, thanks for that. And I'll just touch on briefly in relation to Banksia Hill. So Banksia Hill, it's one of 17 youth detention centres right across the country. It's the only one in Western Australia. It opened up in 1997. Since then, there's been 10,000 people approximately that have gone through Banksia Hill. 70% do go into adult carceral estates. Some of the treatments and the allegations, and Jerry and I, we've collected over 580 testimonies from right across Western Australia about people's time while they've been in Banksia Hill, and numbers are still growing in terms of the testimonies. The mistreatment, the inhumane treatment, the slamming to the ground, the allegations of maggots in the food, the allegations of, you know, children being treated inappropriately, the access to education, the access to psychological services and so forth. These are some of the harrowing allegations, and it gets worse than that. that that have come out of that place, and these are being told through the stories and the testimonies that we've collected. Now, in terms of defunding the police, we have to kind of like be careful around the language, because we do know that the police do a good job in many circumstances, and we do need the police in so many regards. But what I, and in terms of that support for that campaign, I really appreciate it. Reducing the funding to the police and instruments like Department of Child Protection, we need to kick in the support. So whilst they get a budget, the police, and also Department of Child Protection, and for example, with Department of Child Protection, it's a $6 billion corporation right across the nation, and only 17% of that is spent on family support. It needs to be the other way around. The same with the police. The spends need to be the other way around, to the point where it's not punitive, it's not about locking people up. It's about providing that support. So some of you police that work with the youth, that needs to be beefed up to ensure that they're reaching the most marginalised and vulnerable children across the nation. That's really quite important. So we basically need to redirect the funding. The redirect the funding, instead of responding to crime and distress calls all the time, there needs to be about reinvestment within the police itself to community issues that can actually prevent crime and have that strong relationship. But that can only be done with a consultation, the partnership and negotiation with the community, and also those that are affected by the deficit discourse, by being in the system where it has wronged them. We do know there's rogue behaviour. That's reality. There is rogue behaviour in the police department, and there has to be the checks and balances. But in terms of defunding the police, we just kind of like need to be a little bit careful with that language. The language needs to be about redirecting the funding internally to ensure that it's more community-driven instead of being too punitive, and making sure that the support are there for those that are coming into the system. The reality is, and the same with when Jerry Georgiadis and I worked up at Acacia Prison, where we reduced the incarceration rate and the number of people hurting themselves, the same out at Banksia Hill, it's about spreading the love, the intense psychosocial support, the assertive outreach, the 24/7. Not spread the hate, because we know by spreading the hate, that does not work. It makes it too punitive. It makes people hate the system even more. But we also know that defunding the police, it has some interest, but to my mind, the funding needs to be redirected internally to ensure that there's the supports in the community.
That was the second Senate candidate for the Social Justice Independents, Megan Cracker, speaking to us on a wide variety of subjects, and a very powerful voice is Megan Cracker's, as I'm sure you'll agree.
We were really, really lucky to get to chat to her today. So, Megan, if you're listening, thank you so much for coming on at short notice and having a chat to us. A good way of seeing where a government's priorities lie is obviously to follow the money. And the Liberal Party's recent budget announcement was a really important opportunity for Scott Morrison to show us his vision for another term in government, and to give us an idea of where his priorities would lie in that instance. And, you know, despite being the future of our world, young people are largely underrepresented in political decision making. And as such, our needs are often deeply overlooked when it comes to government spending on the things that young people care about, such as climate change. And I'm really lucky to volunteer for a youth-led human rights organisation called Voices of Influence. So that's just a little disclaimer of a conflict of interest coming up. But yeah, Voices of Influence is dedicated to facilitating youth participation in democratic processes. And I sat down with our founder, Alice Langton, and our legal and political affairs director, Taylor Sporowski, to talk about the key budget areas that are impacting young people, and where young people are being overlooked, and just the overarching issue of the underrepresentation of youth in federal decision making. So my first question was to Taylor, talking about what she thinks the budget is actually saying about the Liberal Party's current priorities.
I think what this budget tells us about the Morrison government's priorities is that they are misplaced, and that is extremely disappointing. I think that from the perspective of young people, with the federal budget, it's obvious that there is a serious disconnect between young people and the government. And without collaboration, there is very little solution available.
So what are some of the sort of big ticket items in the budget, and, you know, in terms of like, what are the big announcements that are going to be impacting young people the most?
Yeah. So really, outside of these workforce programs, there's not a lot to be fussed over if you're under 25 with this federal budget. So the government has announced that they have a new apprentice scheme. But to look at what the scheme doesn't address is the over 300,000 young people who are underemployed and work in, you know, an increasingly casualized workforce. So more support is needed for young people who are interested in jobs that are outside of aged care and trade. Something that's piqued everyone's interest after some, you know, precarious interviews with Scott Morrison lately is first home buyers. And, you know, the federal government's approach to, you know, the high cost of living and rent is to, we'll just buy a house, right? So the government has extended their first home buyer scheme. So now people only need to have a 5% deposit to buy a house, and they don't need to have any lender's mortgage insurance. And, you know, although this might help some young people and just first home buyers in general, so many young people, particularly those that are under 25, are already priced out of the housing market. So, you know, really, how many people are going to benefit from the scheme when you can't even crack in the first place? And, you know, as most people would agree, it's very difficult to rent and to save and to live. So another big ticket item, obviously, in the whole sort of big focus of this year's budget is the cost of living and lowering the cost of living. And, you know, the biggest things with that would be the decreasing of the fuel tax, tax refunds and offsets, and then some one-off payments. I mean, you know, anything is going to provide a little bit of relief, like monetary relief to young people that are struggling with these increased costs of living. But this is definitely not a long-term solution. And that's the whole problem, right? It's that a lot of these things are short-term and they're band-aid, but, you know, we're not addressing systemic issues that keep young people in cycles of poverty and low socioeconomic status and things like that.
Climate change is obviously one of the biggest concerns for young people today. And in a very big way, young people are at the forefront of the climate movement. And it just constantly seems to be falling on deaf ears, and particularly on ScoMo's ears, who we know is a avid coal lover. And we know climate change isn't a priority for him. But I think what's particularly interesting about this is the fact that young people are on the forefront of this climate movement. It is the kind of one of the biggest things that young people are concerned about. And to have Scott Morrison completely sort of overlook that and actually slash spending on climate, I'm just interested in, you know, what you think that says about whether or not Scott Morrison actually cares about what young people want or think.
The lack of funding and priority and policy placed on climate justice is a direct attack on young people, because this is our future and it's our planet. There is absolutely no help or hope for us in this budget because of how far down the federal government has put climate justice and action on the policy agenda. So, you know, just to reiterate, the budget has no direct attention or action on climate change. There is no new direct funding in the budget for renewable energy generation projects. Instead, the government is investing just under $250 million over 5 years to support investment in low emission technologies, including hydrogen. And that's sort of the coalition's angle, is that, you know, technology will lead us out of the climate crisis. But I think they're a little bit disillusioned on that front, just because we need renewable energy. Because at the moment, you know, creating the hydrogen to use as a fuel source reduces emissions. And while projects are being proposed at various stages, it's still unclear how long it's going to take to reach the scale needed for it to be, you know, a viable alternative to fossil fuels. So I think, to answer your question, it really affirms the weight that our current federal government feels young people have and the stake that they have in this future. So yeah, it's really, really disappointing.
I think going off what you just said, I think I remember people saying that we have, what, 7 more budgets until 2030? Yep. Is that correct? And obviously 2030 is an international goal to reduce carbon emissions and to really take proper action on climate justice. And that really kind of brought it home to me is that there are only 7 more budgets between now and reaching that goal at 2030. And this is reflective of what's expected in future. It is harrowing and terrifying.
And, you know, to go in the reverse direction of what Alice is talking about, the Liberal government has delivered 9 budgets with no action on climate change. You know, when you've held the power for nearly a decade, surely a decade is enough time for you to have some kind of a impactful rollout of important social or environmental policy. Even the money that's being invested into low emission technologies, they're tone deaf to what long-term solutions are and what we actually need because they don't care. So they haven't cared for the past decade.
That's the thing. They've had a very long time. This has been a conversation for a very long time and they've just consistently kind of negated their responsibility. And then, yeah, in this current climate, when we've got young people at the forefront of this saying, hey, this is our future, they're still overlooking young people and in a very obvious way, like we've seen in the budget. So, yeah, I guess this actually kind of leads into a bigger conversation, which is about the underrepresentation of young people in federal decision making. Like, where are our voices in these conversations? And how do we even get our voices heard? Because when we protest, it's not being heard. So Alice, you started Voices of Influence to try and actually bridge that gap and get more young people in taking an active role in democracy and human rights. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit more about this and what this gap actually looks like.
Yeah, sure. So the gap is very obvious. And I think, you know, we don't have to look very far to see how that gap is manifesting. I think when we're looking at young people, there are structural and conceptual barriers in place to recognizing us as the leaders, not only of tomorrow, but the leaders of today as well. We don't have to look very far to see that young people really are today's leaders. Last week at the School Strike for Climate, where we saw thousands of school students around Australia and globally take a stance for climate justice. And that is a youth-led movement. We don't have to look very far at all. We look at the Black Lives Matter movement that happened during the first year of COVID, which had significant influence, again, was orchestrated and led by young people. If we look at the Global South, there's a massive movement happening towards youth leadership and the recognition of that leadership and power of influence. So I guess like the reason that VOI or Voices of Influence was established was really the precipice of that frustration for me of recognizing that young people are the most divisive generation we have. Gen Z continuously proves that they have the skills, the knowledge, the passion and the drive to really create a better world for tomorrow. But our decision makers and those who are in Parliament aren't listening to us, nor do they give us the opportunity to really have our voice be heard.
You're tuned in to RTR FM 92.1, and this is the Indie Media Show with Kelly Warden and Alex Wisson. We're speaking to Alice Langton and Taylor Sporovsky from Voices of Influence Australia, a national youth-led human rights organisation that's dedicated to carving out space for young people to take part in democratic processes and advocate for the social issues they care about. Today, Alice and Taylor are giving us a breakdown on how the Liberal Party's federal budget impacts young people and the issue with the underrepresentation of youth voices in federal decision-making.
You know, I think people often joke that young people think that the weight of the world is on our shoulders, and I think it is. And I always live by the philosophy that we're not inheriting the world from our ancestors, we're borrowing it from our children. So we all have a responsibility to kind of lead forward for a better tomorrow. And I think young people are the people that are going to be doing that, and they're doing that now. The issue is, as I said before, there's both structural and conceptual barriers in place. Young people are seen as threats or bludgers on the system that don't have anything to contribute, or that they're just objects of our current political system rather than subjects that have value and influence. And then the structural, like, the barrier in place is that there aren't enough opportunities or platforms for young people to be participating in these democratic processes. Kelly, you mentioned protesting. Obviously, protesting is an absolute, like, or peaceful protesting is a human right and a massive part of democracy. But it's not, even then, people aren't hearing the voices of young people. So, again, that's kind of why we established VOI as well, is to create a space for young people to be able to participate meaningfully in democracy. So,
yeah, absolutely. And that actually answered what was going to be my next question, which was, the key barriers that are facing young people in terms of getting involved in informing political decision making. And as you say, there's kind of these conceptual and structural barriers of, like, the way that young people are perceived within those democratic spaces, just being, you know, the objects of policy rather than the subjects. And then, like, kind of not having the spaces where young people have a platform.
Absolutely.
I guess this leads on to the next question as to, what does this actually look like? Like, what is the impact that this underrepresentation is having on young people? And, you know, what kind of main areas are we being overlooked when it comes to government policy?
Well, we're being overlooked in every area. Yeah. You agree? In every single area, we're being overlooked. And I think because of the underrepresentation, the issues that we really care about are being completely overlooked as well.
I think the core issue is that we're not taken seriously. And so I think when you're not taken seriously as an entire demographic, there are such misunderstandings of intersectionality. And so when you can't even understand how different layers of oppression can overlap, the impact of the underrepresentation is the lack of change and the lack of action on important issues.
I think also the thing that we, you know, the elephant in the room is this ultimately is a power issue. When we're talking about the underrepresentation of anything, it's the fact that our decision makers aren't willing to relinquish the power back to the community, whether that's as you're a young person or a woman or a person of color or Indigenous. It's not just young people that are underrepresented in the governance of our decisions or in our government in general. But when we're talking about the underrepresentation of communities, we're talking about an issue of power, an imbalance of power, a relinquishment of that power. And as soon as our decision makers are able to recognize the importance of relinquishing that power back to the community in all of their diversity, and until our government actually reflects the diversity that Australia is, we're not, like, these issues that we care about are not going to have much traction towards them, or change about these issues aren't going to be achieved.
And I think something you kind of touched on was this cultural idea that, like, young people are these sort of uninformed, idealistic subjects of the political decision making. And I think this often ties back into that conversation around education and young people not actually being educated properly within the current school system around what their rights are as young people and what voting is about and how to vote and where to get your information and how to fact check information, you know, in this age of misinformation and kind of political propaganda. And so I guess something that I wanted to get both of your input on is, obviously, heading into an election, what's your sort of advice to young people about voting and why it's so important and how they make those informed decisions?
Now more than ever, you should not be withdrawing from political conversation. You know, Kelly, you mentioned that, you know, you never taught these things. It's like, well, these institutions, these power structures don't want you to know how it works properly, because
it works for them. But they don't know. Yeah.
You're a threat. You become a threat to power, to history, to tradition. Then all of a sudden, they're not locked in and guaranteed with their influence. So that's why you'll find that, you know, particularly the coalition, the Liberals, they don't have a lot of voting guides available for young people, because they're not really that you're not their voting group. Like, that's not who they're trying to appeal to. And they also don't want you to know exactly how it works, because then you might be inclined to not vote for them. So I think, you know, to answer your question about some advice to young people about voting, I think it starts with not being an apathetic voter. So, you know, where you shouldn't be ignoring the increasing doom of social issues from the actions of the current federal government. I think it's sort of like understanding that when you vote not only for you, but for community. And it's this tool of democracy that we have directly. And we, you know, it's inalienable, it's our innate right. And it's really important that we make informed voting choices that not only serve the needs of us, you know, as young people perhaps, but also marginalized communities, and just thinking a bit more broadly about what a particular government in power could mean for the country as a whole, and for particularly people that are already underneath the boot of the system.
I think just adding on to that, I think like as young people, we've been consistently from the age of 18, I think we've been gaslit as a collective to think that young votes don't have any influence. But we know that from the last election, over 800,000 people either didn't show up to vote. I'm sorry, 800,000 young people didn't show up to vote, either completely boycotted the voting system or just wrote doodles or whatever, completely, like, yeah, just didn't take it seriously. And 800,000 people is a significant amount of people.
They could have changed the election outcome.
Absolutely, literally. And that's like what if there's any takeaway from this, is that as young people, we quite literally have the power to swing this election as a demographic. But going off what Taylor just said, it's important that we're informed. And by no means is this like us telling you who to vote for, but it's rather like by completely exercise all the agency and control that you have in your world to be able to make an informed decision.
Alrighty, that was Alice Langton and Taylor Sporovsky from Voices of Influence Australia talking about the impacts of the federal budget on young people and just the issue with the underrepresentation of young people in federal decision making as a whole, and making a very good point there about the importance of, you know, taking your vote seriously, and how in the last election 800,000 young people didn't vote, and, you know, that could swing an election. And yeah, just wanting to plug that if there are any young people listening who are, you know, concerned, maybe it's the first time you're voting in the election and wanting to find out a little bit more about how to make a good and informed decision, Voices of Influence does actually have a resource on their website called How Do I Not Fuck This Up? A Guide for Young People Who Want to Influence Election Outcomes. So do go check that out.
That is fabulous. Now, unfortunately, we run out of time, however, so do stay tuned for Out to Lunch coming up next on your dials, RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative with Grace. It's been a pleasure, Kelly. Great to be in the studio with you.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'll be in again soon. And, of course, stay tuned again next week for another fine edition of the Indie Media Show.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?